Of course, coming from the Isle of Man, going to Port Aire and Port St. Mary was just like home for us. We both knew the place. It wasn't far from where Nina was born. Only about 12 miles from where I was brought up. So we knew what we were coming to, and of course we weren't disappointed. Port St. Mary is a lovely little place with a beautiful little semicircle sandy beach that was good for the children to play on. And just almost alongside the lighthouse buildings, there was a sub-post office, a chemist shop, a general store, and a cafe, ice cream parlour, coffee place, whatever you call them. It was called Smoky Joe's, and the children, they loved the ice cream at Smoky Joe's, so they were regular visitors there. Yes, we really liked living there. And the flat was quite comfortable and good size. Well, it was two bedrooms, if I remember right. Actually, it was two or three, I think it was two. It was a good size and well equipped. The principal keeper, his name was Roberts. He must have liked Port St. Mary. He must have liked the chicken shop. He must have been a glutton for punishment. That's all I can say. To me it was punishment. But apparently when his term of service was up, he'd asked if he could stay on there. So by the time we got there, he'd been there 8 or 9 years. Then the first assistant was an extremely nice chap. Jimmy McGaw, his name was. He was married, had a family. Scotchman. Roberts was a Scotchman too, but so was Jimmy McGaw. And then the other man, his name was Tony Gross. He was younger than me, Tony. He'd come from Laxey on the Isle of Man. Now the boatman, he used to take the lighthouse boat out to do the reliefs, was a local man. His name was Johnny Gorm. He was a really nice chap, in his late 50s I would say. Now the boat he had was specially built for doing reliefs at the Chicken's Rock. They could only do the reliefs when it was low tide and the rocks were exposed. And the only way of getting in there was a narrow little tiny creek, not much wider than the width of the boat. So this boat had been specially built with a reinforced steel bow, so that when they made the relief, Johnny used to line, when they got out by the lighthouse, he used to get the bow right in line with this creek, increase speed and go straight in and ram it right up on the rock until the boat was on the rock. And that was it. It was quite a good manoeuvre. He was very clever at it. And he showed me how to do it, and a couple of times he let me take the boat in, which I enjoyed. Oh yes, he was a very nice chap. Now the accommodation in on the crew of the lifeboat, the boat, two of the men were retired lifekeepers too, in their 60s. Now the accommodation inside the lighthouse was very small, smaller than the Bell Rock. The living room wall, I would say, was less than 3 good paces across. But, of course, you've got to realise in that circle, you had a fire for cooking and keeping you warm. There was benches fitted around the walls. There was cupboards built on the walls for keeping the food in and everything, what have you. The bench seats, they had lids on, like, and you could store things in. And then there was a table, so you had to work your way around the table to get out. Now, directly under the light room, that's at the top of the lighthouse, there was a floor called the storeroom. Now, in there was different things for the light, for weather observations and the radio telephone to the shore, and cupboards with stores in, including explosives and detonators for use during fog. Now, underneath that was a cabin which I shared with Tony Gross, or the other chap when he was on duty. Then below that floor, the principal keeper's room, he had his own room. Then underneath that room was the mess room I've just described, where we used to have our meals. And below that was another couple of floors for storage of oil and coal. Now, when fog fell, there was no fog on like the Pentland Skerries. On top of the dome was a long metal jointed arm, and there was a wheel in the room under the light room which you wound, and it brought this arm down. Now, on it was a hook to put you fitted an explosive charge with a detonator in it. The wheel was then turned to raise the arm to its highest extent. Once there, you pushed down the handle of a battery box that was on the floor in the light room, and that exploded the charge. It was quite a loud bang too. I reckon it could be heard for a couple of miles or so. This was set off every few minutes while the fog persisted. Johnny Gorn, the old chap for the boatman, he had a good job there. He was on a good salary, and he had a house provided with an annual supply of coal. And by the quayside, he had a good big boat shed where supplies and paints and lighthouse stores and things were kept. You can always find Johnny in his boat shed, feet up on a box, reading or listening to the radio and having a smoke. He only went out to the lighthouse once a fortnight with the relief and stores, unless, of course, there was an emergency. I used to joke with him and say, "Let me know when you're going to retire, Johnny, and I'll put in for your job." I'd have liked it, no? I really would. One thing you missed on the lighthouse when you were out there was a toilet. There were no toilets, so you had to use a bucket. And someone sometime had made a seat to fit this bucket. Then when you'd finished doing the necessary, you had to go out onto the balcony and throw it over the side, being very careful of which way the wind was blowing. Yes, that was one thing you missed. But I enjoyed the watch keeping, especially in summer. There were quite a lot of ships went past the Chicken's Rock. Every time I saw them, part of my heart went with them. I used to think of the times when I was at sea, and the ships and the faces I'd known. The faces of the old shipmates used to flash through my mind. And the humour of those days, and sayings, like, when you went ashore you had no money, you had very little money. You couldn't afford to go to a bar or a cinema or anything. So you would end up in the Seaman's Mission, where there was free teas and coffee and cakes. And they called that Harry Freeman's. There was a Harry Freeman's in every port in the world, flying missions to seamen. And then I recalled to mind a notice on the wall of the mess room on the Natasina, which said, "There are three things which no one must mention in this mess room: religion, politics, or a woman's name." I often wondered why a woman's name. That was it. When you arrived in a strange port, quite a lot of the blokes would be in their cabins and they'd put their heads out through the portholes. I remember one ship, they were doing that, and there was someone, some wise guy up on deck leaning over the rail shouted, "Put your heads in, they'll think it's a cattle boat." Yeah, get your heads in, people ashore will think it's a cattle boat. And I remembered leaving Liverpool on the Strategist. There were quite a few wives down seeing their men off, because it was a Liverpool ship. I always remember one woman shouting out to her husband, "Don't worry about the wages, come home sunburned." For the memories, happy days and memories. When you were at sea, you always wish you were ashore. And when you were ashore, you always wish you were at sea. I think that's what being a seaman was. Wishing all your life. I was on the balcony one day with Jimmy McGaw, and quite a large cargo liner was going by. And I said to Jimmy, "That's a nice ship." He said to me, "What ship?" I thought he was joking. But no, he couldn't see it. I'd noticed for a while that they'd been taking a lot of aspirins and having headaches. Seemed to be always having headaches. So I said to him then, "There's quite a big ship there, Jimmy. You'd better go and see the doctor when you're ashore and get your eyes tested." So he said he would. He was an awful nice chap, Jimmy. And when he went ashore, he saw a doctor, and apparently the doctor told him he was losing his sight. So he was invalided out of the service and never came out to the Rock again. Poor Jim. He stayed on living in Port St. Mary, and eventually he died there. But I think most of his family stayed there and are still there. One of his daughters worked in my sister Connie's husband's office. Anyway, Jimmy was replaced by another Manxman, a youngish chap, tall, thin chap with glasses. His name was Christian. And so the time went on out there. I was there for about 2 years. I didn't care for the Rock itself, the lighthouse. It was a bad station. But the family and I really liked living in Port St. Mary. And the two daughters had become great friends with a little girl named Jochen, I think her name was. Her parents had the general store just a few doors away from the lighthouse buildings. And something in my memory said, this young girl, she died very young, in her teens, I think. Something. I just can't properly recall. But whilst I was stationed at the Chicken's Rock, my old shipmate, Les Prattley from the Matasina, who had been living in London, had come to the island to work and live. He was an accountant at a firm called, I think it was called, Marine Paints. It was good to see him and his wife now and again, yarn about old times. But back on the Rock, I was beginning to get a bit fed up with Tony Gross. He was a jovial sort of a chap, and we used to play cards and cribbage and that, but he had some dirty habits. Oh, he had some awful dirty habits. When the boat came out with stores, all hands had to help, even the cook. Now stores, apart from food and one thing or another, also meant paraffin oil for the light and coal for fire. On this occasion, Tony was on Cook's turn, it was his turn. When the stores came, he had to help, just as he was in the middle of making some pastry. So we all went down and we unloaded the boat and stacked the stores. And then as soon as we'd finished, Tony went straight back into the kitchen, never washed his hands, and started making pastry. Now, he'd been handling drums of paraffin, which are always leak a bit, and coal, bags of coal. His hands were filthy, and he just put it straight in the pastry and started mixing it. I got onto him, I said, "Hey, you dirty sod, why don't you wash your hands first?" He said, "Oh, don't be so fussy. You've got to eat a bit of dirt before you die. Besides, pastry is good for cleaning the dirt out of your, from your fingernails." This Christian chap there, he just left with Tony. Oh, but after that, I couldn't eat anything that Tony made. Well, I come ashore, I told Nina I was going to look for another job. I'll look out for somewhere else. So on one spell ashore, I saw a steward's job vacant at the automobile club in Hill Street in Douglas. So I rang up and applied, and I had an interview, but I didn't get the job. Now, the day after, I got a message to contact a lawyer in Douglas. His name was Farger. I said, Farger or Farragher? Farger, I think. So I rang him, and he said that he had heard that I'd failed to get the automobile club job as steward. He was on the committee there, and he wanted me, but would I be interested in managing a country pub? So I asked him which pub, but he wouldn't say. He asked me to go to his office and bring Nina, and he would take us to see it. So I asked him again, but he was a damn one. He wouldn't give me the name of the place. So we went into Douglas, and we went to his office in Athol Street. And he only had one arm; it was amputated from the shoulder. So I asked him again, what was the name of the pub? I'd like to know, but he still wouldn't tell me. He said, "Oh, you'll see when we get there. I'm going to run you down now." So he got up, got the keys, and took it down a car. And we got in the car, and he shot off. Cooey, went a hell of a speed. Nina and I were a bit worried the speed he was going. Anyway, he drove us down to the beach at Port Sodrick. So he said, "This is the hotel, the Port Sodrick Hotel." "So what do you think?" he said. I said, "Oh, I don't know," he said. "Oh, it's been closed all winter, so it won't be in spotless condition, you know." He said, "You'll just have to half close your eyes and visualize what it'll be like when it's cleaned up." It was about 4 or 5 weeks before Easter. So he opened the door, and we went in, and what a mess. You would have never seen anything like it in your life. Apparently what had happened when the place closed the previous September, the staff, as soon as they'd got the customers out, had just downed tools and locked the door, put the lights out and locked the door. There was all dirty plates on the tables with parts of the meal people had been having, and all the dirty cutlery and dirty glasses everywhere. Papers and cigarette packets and cigarette ends everywhere. There was parts of the bones of chops, and you can see where rats had been chewing at them. Cool. Both our hearts went right down to our shoes. So he said, "Don't think of it like this, it will be all cleaned up." And I said, "Well, we got 2 children, they will have to go, we'd have to be near school." So he said, "Oh, we'll provide you with a little van." So I couldn't drive, I was no use to me. So he says, "Now, oh, come on, what do you think of it? Just pick it, it'll be cleaned up." And so I said, "Well, who would we be working for? Who does it belong to? Who would be our bosses?" He said, "Well, I can't disclose that. But all your dealings will be made through me." So I said, "Well, we'll think about it and we'll talk it over." So he said, "Okay, but I want an answer pretty soon, so don't leave it too long, let me know." So then he ran us back to Douglas. So we went up to see my sister Connie. She was living in Westminster Terrace then. And her husband Herbert, he was secretary to the local government board, and he'd worked at the courthouse for some years. So I told him all about it, and what did he think about it? So he said to me, "Well, Arthur," he said, "my advice would be to think twice and think a lot each time." He said, "I don't seem to trust Varga too much. Herbert had known him for years." So we decided then. So I rang Varga and told him no. So it was back to the Chicken's Rock. This time out, I'd finally made my mind up to leave. I'd mentioned some to the principal, Mr. Roberts, about some of Tony's dirty habits, and he wouldn't change. But he wasn't interested. He didn't want any troubles. He didn't have long to go before he retired. That's why he hadn't wanted to move from the Chicken's Rock. He was wanting to retire and stay there. Anyway, one night, I was in bed fast asleep when something woke me up. I could hear something noises like scraping and scratching. At first I thought it was rats, but then I'd never heard or never seen any rats on a lighthouse. Chaps had told me they never come on a lighthouse, so it was only mostly stone walls and stone floors, so rats don't like that. So I realised eventually it was in the storeroom up above our cabin. So I went up there and I got the shock of my life. There was Tony Gross with a lighted taper in his hand and his head inside the cupboard where all the explosives were stored. I couldn't speak. I was frozen to the spot. I was afraid to say anything or touch him in case he moved and the lighter would blow the whole lot up. After what seemed an eternity, he eased himself back out of the cupboard. As soon as he was clear of the cupboard, I moved forward and grabbed the lighted taper and put the light out. I said to him, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" He said, "Oh, this fog coming up. I was getting some explosives ready, but I couldn't find the detonators. I wouldn't like to repeat what I called him." But I told him, you know, he could have blown the whole lot of it sky high. I couldn't get back to sleep, so I stayed and watched with him in case he'd done something else silly. I didn't say anything to anyone else, but I made my mind up there and then that was it, that was enough. I'd had enough. When I got ashore, I would never go back to the Chicken's Rock again. And it was right. I had another couple of weeks to go. But as soon as I got ashore, I told Nina all about it. So I got the local paper, but there was no jobs going in it. I bought the Liverpool Echo. And in it, I saw there was a job for a steward groundsman at the Dunlop Social Club in Sudham, Rochdale, Lancashire. And there was a phone number. I asked Nina what she thought about it, so she said okay. So I rang up and spoke to the chap, and then he asked me if I could come across to the mainland the following day for an interview. So I went, I had the interview. It was quite an awful nice chap. Well, there were three of them who interviewed me, and they were all very nice. I had a look around the place, and I thought it would be all right. Anything to get away from that chicken's rock. So I went back to Port St. Mary and told her that they said we could start in a fortnight's time, so she was all right about it. So then I phoned the Northern Lighthouse Board in Edinburgh that I was resigning as from that time and that the resignation was in the post. They asked me to go out and back again at the end of my fortnight's leave. So they had time to fix up a replacement. So I said, no way. So they asked me why I was wanting to resign. So I said, for personal reasons, I can't go out there again. I'm sorry, I can't say any more. They weren't very pleased, but they arranged for the, or told me to arrange for the local occasional keeper to go out there until a permanent replacement could be arranged. So that's how and why I left the lighthouse service, with mixed feelings and quite a bit of sadness, because I hadn't minded the lighthouse service. I liked it. It was close to the sea and the money was good. You were supplied with uniforms, so you saved on clothes. And all your household items were paid for. You had no rent to pay. Everything was so good, it was just totally gross. Anyway, so I left. And we'd only left the Chicken's Rock. There'd only be about 12 months afterwards when the Chicken's Rock went on fire and was completely gutted. Absolutely gutted, and it has never been manned by men since. There's never been men on duty out there since. Luckily, it happened at low tide, and the three men managed to get out onto the rocks and wait there until the boat got out there to pick them up. There were all sorts of inquiries as to what happened and different stories of what happened, and I often wondered. Every time I thought about it, I could see Tony Gross in that cupboard with a lighted taper. I'm probably most likely wrong for saying he was the cause of it, but I can often think of it. My heart stopped, I can assure you. I got busy making crates and cartons for our bits of furniture. I'd priced all round and found that that was the cheapest way to send the goods, doing it myself and direct by the Isle of Man Steam Packet Company. It was hard work, but Johnny Gorn gave me a bit of a hand. He was a good friend, making crates. So we sent the goods off in a lorry, said our goodbyes to friends in Port St. Mary, and then we went to Douglas to say goodbye to the family and friends in Douglas. We stayed overnight at my sister Winnie's, and the following morning we said goodbye to her and the family and caught the boat to Liverpool. Leaving the boat at Liverpool, we caught the train at Lime Street station and set off to Rochdale. From Rochdale station we caught a bus to Sudden, that's the part of just on the outskirts of Rochdale where the club was. To reach the club we had to walk up an extremely long drive of about 400 yards, surrounded by loads of tall trees and bushes. Reaching the clubhouse, it was a big stone-built house that had been the home of a wealthy mill owner in days gone by. The road there, where the entrance to the drive was, that was on the main Rochdale to Manchester Road. At the rear of the clubhouse was a soccer pitch, an extremely good cricket field, and a first-class bowling green. And the bowling green was used for the Rochdale Observer bowling tournament every year. That was one of the biggest competitions in the north of England. It was an absolutely first-class and bowling green, and was hired out at times at different competitions. Across the road from the playing fields was the massive mill buildings of the Dunlop Cotton Mills, to whom the club belonged. They made industrial belting for the mines, and canvas for shoes and many other products. We were told that about 1,000 people were employed there. It was a massive mill. We were welcomed to the club by the club chairman. His name was John Traynor, and he worked in the mill. And also the welfare officer, who was also the club secretary. He was a Mr. Bayard Grimshaw. He was an extremely nice chap, very well educated man. He was a magician and a mind reader. Along with his wife, they formed a team, Bayard and Marion, and appeared on the stage and in concerts. And they also had their own series on TV for a while, which we used to watch. They were on while we were in Rochdale. They showed us around the building. It was quite a big place. It really was. Upstairs was our two-bedroom flat. That was sealed off from the rest of the building with walls, three plywood walls and the doors, so nobody could get into the flat. And then also upstairs were two billiard rooms and a table tennis room. They were fair size. If I'm not mistaken, the one billiard room had two tables in, and the other had one in. And then from the landing, there was a magnificent, or it had been a magnificent, staircase with decorated mouldings on the wall as you came down. And above it was a glass dome. On the ground floor, there was a good-sized ballroom. Now, that had a bar at one end, and it was used for dances and concerts. Opposite the ballroom was a good-sized television lounge with quite a number of big upholstered armchairs in, and thick carpets on the floor. It was a beautiful room. There was another lounge that was called the Green Lounge, because the walls were like a very pale green, and all the decoration was green. Now, that was used for various meetings. It also had a big music centre in, where some crowd came. They were called the Music Circle. They used to play classical music. People who appreciated that type of music. Now, at the end of the hall was the main bar, or as the locals there called it, the tap room. It was a good size with a reasonable, it wasn't a very big bar to service it, but it was big enough. Opposite the tap room was a massive kitchen with cupboards on the floor down both sides of the room. Now, these were topped with wooden benches, must have been 2 to 3 inches thick, the full length of the room. And then in the centre of the room was a massive workbench, almost the full length of the room. This had cupboards underneath and a thick wooden top too. In the basement was the beer cellar, which was quite large. And a large room in which was a big metal bath, big enough to hold two soccer teams. And also, in the same passageway, were six dressing rooms. So you'll gather it was quite a big building and took some cleaning. Well, that was just to be Nina and I, just the two of us. So we had all that to keep clean, as well as run the bar.
On the massive lawn in the front of the building was an 18-hole putting green. It was very popular in the summertime. At the rear were two tennis courts. Now, alongside the side of the house, the building, was a pathway that led to the road at the end, where the mill was situated. Halfway down this footpath was the old coachman's cottage. Mr. Grimshaw and his wife lived there. A few yards away from the cottage was the old coach house and stables. These were occupied by the ground staff, plus all the equipment required to tend the pitches, etc. There were three groundsmen, two chaps in their late 50s, I would say, maybe turned 60. I can't remember their names. One was a little thin, weedy chap. And then there was a tall, younger man whose first name, his name was Huey Muldowney. He was a really first-class cricketer, and he played for a team in the Lancashire League. Now, they were supervised by the head groundsman, a man in his late 50s, I would say, named Archie. I don't know what his second name was. These chaps, they really did work hard, and they kept the grounds in immaculate condition. Trees and bushes were everywhere between the various pitches and extending down to the roads. In all, the grounds must have covered about 15 to 20 acres, I would think. Alas, it's all gone now. The whole area was knocked down and built up on. And now it's a modern housing estate. Covered the whole area. What a shame. It was a really, really nice spot. The bar was really well stocked with all kinds of wines and spirits and bottled beers. We also stocked different draft beers. There was the finest bitter beer I have ever tasted in my life. It was brewed by Ramsden's of Halifax. Another good bitter was Sam Smith's of Tadcaster. I rather liked that one too. And then we had another one called Whittaker's Cock of the North. That was a draft beer. I think that came from Halifax too. But Ramsden's book was by far the most popular. By far. Everybody loved that beer. We settled in fine and soon made friends with the people who used the facilities. The bar was open from noon till 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. until I think it was 10 p.m. on weeknights and 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday nights. There were long hours. And during the summer months, the place was open shorter hours on a Sunday, so that made it a 7-day week then. Nina was employed as a cleaner, so we had the two wages, which I can assure you were not very big, the wages, especially when one kid considers the hours we worked. However, the place wasn't as busy as I at first thought it might be. We also had what we call a sweetie counter in the bar too, with bars of chocolates and sweets and crisps and that sort of thing. They were popular with the young teenagers who worked in the mill. When we opened at 12 noon, quite a crowd of these teenagers rushed in, wanting sweets and cokes and soft drinks and that. And then some of the men came in for beers. When they went back to work at 1 p.m. a small number of the office staff used to come in for drinks. But in summertime it was busy at lunchtimes. They used to take the drinks out and that outside and sit on the grass and have them. Then they used to leave all their glasses out there too to be collected by Nina and I. Opening at 4 p.m. was a bit stupid. We never saw anyone for at least an hour. And then maybe only half a dozen to a dozen would come in for a drink before going home. And they were usually the ones who lived locally. Because, as I say, there were about 1,000 people working at that mill, so we were told. And they came from all over the Rochdale area, the other side of town, and out of town. So when they got finished at work, they wanted to get home. They didn't want to go and sit, drink. They'd go home and have their meals and then get changed and go out drinking in their local pubs. But by 6:30, the few that, 6:30 to 7, the few that came in after 5 o'clock would be gone. In the winter time, many days we wouldn't have another customer, except for one man. I forget his name now. I can see him before me now. Rather small man with glasses, wore a tilby. He was a foreman of one of the departments. He would turn up about 9:30 p.m. religiously every night of the year. And then he'd have one bottle of Mackeson Stout, drink that, and then he'd be off. Friday nights were different. We would have about 15 to 20 or so in the tap room. They played darts, cribbage and draughts, and yarn, telling stories. It was quite humorous. You know, a very, very nice crowd. In the summertime, of course, we used to have quite a lot more because in the evenings there used to be tennis games and evening cricket and bowls on the bowling green, so we were reasonably busier in the summertime. But in the wintertime, people wouldn't walk up that long, poorly lit driveway, not in the dark. They said it was because of the ghost. We took it with a pinch of salt. But they used to tell us the tale, and that Mr. Grimshaw, who had researched the history of the building, he told us it was true. That the son of the old mill owner who had had the place built, had committed suicide by jumping out of an upstairs window. Now, quite a few people told us of seeing the ghost, a man in the grey suit. Mr. Grimshaw and his wife, who were both very well educated people, said that they had seen him on several occasions. We still took it all with a joke. Then one night, after we had finished in the bar, locked up everything, and we went up to this flat. We found the children, Linda and Leslie, both on, they were still under 5. They were still awake. We asked them what was the matter. And they said they were waiting for the man to come back. When Nina asked them, what man? They said the man in the grey suit who came and talked to them and then walked through the wall. Now then, the partition dividing the flat from the club room upstairs had a door, but that door was locked and it was bolted top and bottom, so nobody could get through there. And the only other entrance to the flat was up a flight of stairs facing the bar counter. Now, I'd been stood in that bar all the time, all night, and no one went up there. I've often wondered about it, and since then I've always had an open mind about ghosts. When one hear people talk about ghosts and laughing about them, my mind goes back to that night. Because, as I say, Linda and Leslie, they were only children. They weren't going to school, they were. They'd both be about 3 and 4. So, and we've taught them later years, and they still say they saw that man in the grey suit. So, what can you make of it? It was quite a nice place to live. It was a short bus ride into town where there were some really nice shops. It was a very nice town, Rochdale. Very pleasant, with a beautiful town hall in the centre there. And reasonable, the prices in the shops were very good. And for local shopping, you could take a short walk along either the main road or through the back road, like a lane, up to a little part of the town called Castleton. And there's some quite good shops there, so we usually done our local shopping up in Castleton. And there was a primary school there that later Linda and Leslie both went to, that was their first school, Castleton Primary School. So the children loved it there, because they made friends with all the people who used to come in. They always used to have a word with the kiddies and little play with them, some of the teenagers in the summertime on the grass outside. They'd have a little play with them, so it was very pleasant. And it was hard graft, it was very hard work with long hours and little pay, but we were reasonably happy there.